Appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskov.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalul ladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: a row over the coronavirus vaccine exports in Europe escalates as France accuses the UK of blackmail over the issue. Clashes erupt in Bristol between British police and demonstrators opposing a government bill giving police new powers to restrict protests. Also coming up, police in Bangladesh say 5 people have been killed during violent protests against a visit by Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. It's good to have you with us. Our top story: France has accused Britain of blackmail over the coronavirus vaccine exports amid a growing row over jab supply in Europe.
We cannot deal this way and play blackmail insofar as we wanted to vaccinate without stopping for the first dose, and now we find ourselves a bit handicapped for the second dose. Europe does not have to pay the cost of these policies.
French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian called on the European Union to control exports of the AstraZeneca vaccine. He expressed hope that the EU and the UK can reach an agreement so that the British-Swedish AstraZeneca company can fulfill its vaccine deliveries. Vaccination programs have been sluggish across Europe. The EU blames pharmaceutical companies for their inability to deliver the promised doses. The bloc has warned to ban AstraZeneca's vaccines exports to provide the EU with required doses. An overwhelming majority of UN member states have demanded action be taken to ensure equitable access to COVID-19 vaccines for all people worldwide. Some 180 of the 193 UN members issued a declaration voicing deep concern over what they called uneven distribution of coronavirus vaccines across the world, both among and within countries. They highlighted that many countries do not yet have access to vaccines, demanding global cooperation to increase the production and distribution of vaccines at regional and global levels. This comes as the World Health Organization has criticized what it calls inequity in the distribution of the COVID-19 vaccines. Figures show more than half of the vaccines injected globally have been administered in high-income countries, accounting for only 16% of the global population. Violent clashes have once again broken out in the British city of Bristol as police arrest a number of protesters.
No!
More than 1,000 people protested in the city over a government bill that would give police new powers to restrict street protests. The latest rally was the third demonstration against the bill since last week. Police said some protesters threw projectiles at security forces. The proposed legislation has angered activists, particularly after a heavy-handed police response to a London vigil for murder victim Sarah Everard on March the 13th. Police have faced widespread outrage and condemnation because of their response to the vigil. Staying in the UK, a school in Northern England is in the centre of a media firestorm after suspending a teacher for insulting Islam's Prophet Muhammad. The school apologised to parents after a protest. However, many are unhappy with the school's reaction, claiming that Muslims are breaching freedom of speech. Robert Carter is in Batley to find out more.
In the English town of Batley, a local grammar school has caused major controversy after a teacher showed a blasphemous cartoon of Islam's Holy Prophet Muhammad to students during a religious studies class. Outraged parents of Muslim students began protesting outside the school gates on Thursday, demanding the school take action against Islamophobia.
The incident from Monday, 22nd of March, must also be investigated from a criminal perspective,
yes,
given that it was a clear attempt to stir up religious hatred. We also use this opportunity to call upon the entire British Muslim community to review the materials being taught in their children's schools.
Batley Grammar School reacted quickly, suspending the teacher, launching an investigation, and apologising to parents. However, the British press and politicians have opted to condemn the protesters instead, adding further fuel to the fire.
I was disturbed to see scenes of people protesting outside the school. That is not right. We shouldn't have teachers, members of the staff of schools feeling intimidated.
The creator of the universe, Allah, the most merciful, doesn't need a crowd hanging around outside the school.
Many details about what the protesters have been demanding are not clear. Press TV spoke to locals to find out more.
As far as I know, the parents have been very, very responsible. I mean, many of the protesters are not even parents, and the parents have acted very responsibly, very, very professionally, and they should be commended. You know, they're basically the victims of this situation, but they're also the stars of this situation, that they've basically acted in a calm, collective manner. They've not made any unreasonable demands to the school. They've not asked for anything untoward to happen towards the teacher. They've been very, very responsible, and they should be commended for their stance and for their actions.
The school has acknowledged that the resource used in Monday's lesson was completely inappropriate and had the potential to cause considerable offence within the community. However, many online are now arguing that Muslims need to accept insults on the Holy Prophet as part of freedom of speech, and if they don't like it, they have to essentially lump it. However, with further Muslim action planned elsewhere in the country, and also the media continuing to hype up the story, it's likely that things will continue to escalate going forward. Robert Carter, Batley.
Elsewhere, police in Bangladesh say 5 people have been killed during violent demonstrations against a visit by the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Officials say 4 protesters were shot dead in Hadazari on Friday. Another protester was killed in Brahman Baria after police opened fire at demonstrators. Clashes also erupted between police and protesters in the capital Dhaka, where police fired rubber bullets and tear gas to disperse the crowd. The Friday protests were the latest in a series of demonstrations across Bangladesh to oppose Modi's visit to the country. Modi is visiting Bangladesh on the 50th anniversary of its independence from Pakistan. Bangladeshis accuse him of inciting religious tensions and anti-Muslim violence in India. After detaining hundreds of Rohingya refugees in the Jammu region, India has arrested dozens more in the capital, New Delhi. As our correspondent Manawa Zaman reports, the refugee community is in utter panic and despair, as many fear about their fate.
Indian police raided and detained a family in refugee camp in the outskirts of New Delhi. Members of the community say the police detained a family of 6 without any reasons giving them no chance of even having their breakfast. The whole community is terrified, and panic has gripped the entire camp about their fate.
There is an uneasy calm and a sense of fear in this refugee camp after dozens were detained in recent weeks. Now people are more fearful, anticipating their turn, which they say is inevitable after years of vicious campaigns calling for their expulsion from India.
This refugee, who did not want it to be named, says police and law enforcement agencies frequently visit their camps and ask for their details. He says the visits are more frequent since last few weeks.
We are all terrified. It looks like our legs are broken and we are just alive. Since the Indian government has started detaining our members of our community, the whole camp is gripped in fear. We can't even sleep. We are burdened to everyone and no one cares about us. We are refugees. We came here to save our lives, to save our children. And we are grateful India gave us refuge since years.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different states of India.
Where are we being detained? If we are a problem for India, let them send us to some other country, wherever they feel we are safe. We are already dead, since we belong to nowhere. Now this detention issue is killing us every day and night. We left our country to save our lives. And in India we found peace, despite hardships.
Rights groups have urged India to halt any deportation plan, saying conditions in Myanmar are not conducive. They say the Indian government should uphold its international obligations and protect those in need of refuge within its borders, saying India has hosted refugees from many countries since decades, but adopted an aggressive approach towards Rohingya Muslims in particular. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Well, staying in the region, the Taliban militant group says it will restart the fight against foreign troops in Afghanistan if they do not abide by the May 1st deadline to withdraw. This comes following comments by U.S. President Joe Biden, who said it was hard to meet the agreed timetable for tactical reasons. Meanwhile, German lawmakers have also approved a new mandate for allowing troops to remain in Afghanistan until the end of next January. The former US administration signed the agreement with the Taliban last year. According to the deal, all foreign forces, including Americans, should leave Afghanistan by May the 1st in return for security guarantees from the Taliban. At least 16 people have been killed as fresh clashes erupt between Myanmar security forces and anti-coup demonstrators. Seven of the victims were killed in the country's commercial capital, Yangon. About a dozen were also injured after troops opened fire at the protesting crowd outside a police station there. Nine people were killed in similar protests elsewhere across Myanmar. The country has been in turmoil since the army toppled de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi from power in a coup on February the 1st. Security forces have used tear gas, rubber bullets and live rounds against anti-coup protesters. So far, more than 200 people have been killed in the anti-coup unrest. North Korea says the US President's condemnation of Pyongyang's recent test launch of two ballistic missiles amounts to a, quote, encroachment and provocation. A senior North Korean official said Joe Biden's administration has taken a wrong first step and revealed its deep-seated hostility towards Pyongyang. The official added that the test was self-defensive against the threats posed by South Korea and the U.S. with their joint military exercises. North Korea said this week it successfully fired newly developed tactical missiles. Washington condemned the test as destabilizing. Biden said the missile launch violated UN Security Council resolutions and warned Washington will respond if Pyongyang escalates its weapons tests. The launches marked North Korea's first weapons test since Biden took office in January.
After firing two cruise missiles Sunday, North Korea launched two ballistic missiles early Thursday morning. U.S. President Joe Biden responded.
There will be responses if they choose to escalate. We will respond accordingly. But I'm also prepared for some form of diplomacy, but it has to be conditioned upon the end result of denuclearization.
The latest launches are widely considered to be in violation of UN Security Council sanctions against Pyongyang, which are strongly supported by the United States and limit North Korea's ability to develop its economy. North Korea's recent missile tests demonstrate that maintaining the status quo in terms of ongoing United Nations Security Council sanctions is unacceptable to Pyongyang. And experts agree that the timing of the tests was clearly designed to influence the Biden administration's ongoing North Korea policy review. Experts argue that the U.S. needs to live up to the Singapore summit agreement between former U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, which was violated with recent joint U.S.-South Korea military drills.
From North Korea's perspective, the South Korea-U.S. military exercises, pressure on human rights, and sanctions are threatening. Pyongyang needs to be guaranteed the right to live. If the U.S. has a sincere attitude before approaching North Korea, they will get a response.
U.S. officials recently toured the region to consult allies. With expectations, the Biden administration's new policy toward North Korea will be announced within weeks. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Elsewhere, Yemen is marking the sixth anniversary of the Saudi-led war, which has left the country broken and on the edge of famine. The grinding conflict has sparked what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with some two-thirds of the population in need of aid. We have the details in this report.
The Saudi-led coalition intervened in Yemen militarily in March 2015 to restore to power former President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi. During the years, the Saudi war machine has pounded the poorest Arab nation non-stop. To make matters worse, Saudi Arabia has imposed a blockade on the country, which has badly hampered efforts to save civilian lives. The UN regards the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UN Humanitarian Office puts the Yemen war dead at 233,000. The toll includes 131,000 from indirect causes, such as a lack of food, health services, and infrastructure. According to the World Food Program, out of the 29 million population, over 20 million depend on some form of aid for survival. 4 million have been driven from their homes, more than 16 million face hunger this year, and the rate of child malnutrition is one of the highest in the world. Nearly half of Yemeni children under the age of 5 suffer from acute malnutrition. After 6 years of relentless violence, the kingdom has failed to bring allied politicians back to power. Political commentator Tim Anderson believes Saudi Arabia has failed to achieve any of its objectives in Yemen.
The Saudis, as the spearhead of that, if you like, have not achieved any of their objectives. They've been on retreat for some time now, and as your report points out, that's the Yemenis are pressing their advantage now that they have the upper hand.
Now, Saudi Arabia is coming under growing pressure from the international community to end the war. The new U.S. administration claims it's halted its support for the Saudi-led war, saying there is no military solution. Some European powers have also stopped or suspended arms sales to Riyadh. In the meantime, the Yemeni army launched a major drone and ballistic missile attack against the kingdom's oil infrastructure and military bases. The Saudi-led coalition is also facing intense pressure from a Yemeni offensive on the northern province of Marib. The attacks have dramatically upped the ante for the Saudis, making them feel more than ever the bitter pinch of the war. Political analyst Colin Cavill says the Yemenis have demonstrated the desire and capacity to be free from the decade-long Saudi hegemony.
The Yemeni people have already demonstrated their desire to be free of the Saudi puppets.
The leader of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement has vowed the Yemenis will remain steadfast in resisting the Saudi-led war. Abdul Malik Badreddin al-Houthi has stressed they will continue dealing blows to the Saudis on their own soil as long as the war continues. Riyadh appears to be searching for a way out without having to offer any concession. This week, Saudis offered what they called a comprehensive ceasefire, but Yemenis rejected the proposal as nothing new. They say their attacks won't stop until Saudi Arabia stops its aggression and lifts the air and sea blockade on the country. It remains to be seen if the Saudis will find a face-saving path to exit the military quagmire before the 7th anniversary of the war.
Staying in the region, a collision between two trains in Egypt has killed at least 32 people and injured scores of others. The crash happened in the province of Suhag, south of the capital Cairo. Medical reinforcements, including more than 100 ambulances, have been dispatched to the crash site. Technicians are also trying to remove five dislocated and damaged train wagons. President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has pledged tough punishment for those responsible for the crash. Crumbling infrastructure and poor maintenance is blamed to be the main cause of the crash. Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust. From the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
The fight over voting rights is emerging as one of the defining conflicts of the Biden era. and Georgia fired the opening shot with a set of new restrictions underscoring the political, legal, and financial clashes that will influence whether Republicans retake Congress and the White House. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Nick Corazzaniti and Reed Epstein. The piece is titled Georgia Law Kicks Off Partisan Battle Over Voting Rights. Stay with us for more of Nick Corazzaniti and Reed Epstein's article. The fight over voting rights is emerging as one of the defining conflicts of the Biden era, and Georgia fired the opening shot with a set of new restrictions underscoring the political, legal, and financial clashes that will influence whether Republicans retake Congress and the White House. President Joe Biden on Friday, 26th of March, called Georgia's new law an attack on the Constitution and said the Justice Department was taking a look at Republican voting efforts in the state of Georgia, without offering any specifics. This is Jim Crow in the 21st century. It must end, President Biden said, a day after Governor Brian Kemp signed the bill into law. I will take my case to the American people, including Republicans who joined the broadest coalition of voters ever in this past election, to put country before party. If you have the best ideas, you have nothing to hide. Let the people vote. Civil rights groups immediately challenged the Georgia law in federal courts, backed by prominent Democratic voting rights lawyers. Several black leaders described the legal skirmishes to come as an existential fight for representation, saying the law clearly puts a target on black and brown voters. Protests against voting restrictions unfolded this week in state capitals like Austin, Texas, and Atlanta, Georgia, and more lawsuits are expected. In more than 24 states, Republican-led legislatures are advancing bills in a broad political effort that is the most aggressive attack on right to vote since the civil rights movement of the 1960s. It follows months of Republican efforts to tarnish Joe Biden's presidential victory, which scores of high-level GOP officials still refuse to acknowledge as legitimate. Democrats, who have limited power in many state capitals, are looking to President Biden and congressional Democrats for a new federal law to protect voting. Many in the party see the fight over voting as not just a moral cause, but also a political cause, given their narrow margins of victory in presidential and Senate elections in Georgia, Arizona, and many other battleground states. Georgia's sweeping new provisions passed by a Republican-controlled legislature represent the most substantial overhaul of a battleground state's voting system since last November's election. It would impose stricter voting identification requirements for absentee balloting, limit drop boxes, and forbid giving water and snacks to voters waiting in line. But in a state where former President Donald Trump tried to persuade Republican election officials to reverse its loss, the measure went even further. It shifts the power and oversight of elections to the legislature by stripping the Secretary of State from chairing the State Board of Elections and authorizing the legislature to name members to the board. It further empowers the State Board of Elections to have sweeping jurisdiction over county election boards, including the authority to suspend officials. President Joe Biden on Friday, 26th of March, called Georgia's new voting restrictions un-American and sought to tie them to the Democrats' push in Washington to enact the Federal Voting Rights Bill, which the House of Representatives passed this month. The measure would put in place a raft of requirements intended to protect voting rights, including weakening restrictive state identification requirements, expanding early and mail-in voting, and restoring voting rights to former felons. The president said the new Georgia law was expressly what the House bill was designed to prevent, while Democrats in Congress debate abolishing the filibuster in order to pass the voting rights bill through the Senate. Republican legislators in more than 40 states have introduced hundreds of bills targeting voting access and seizing authority over administering elections. And another crucial conflict looms this autumn. The fight over redistricting to account for growing and changing populations, and the gerrymandering that will allow partisan majorities to limit the impact of votes by packing or splitting up population centers. The gerrymandering disputes will determine the look of the House, and dozens of state legislatures in many cases locking in majorities for the next decade. Bitter struggles over voting rights loom even in states with Democratic governors who can veto the legislation. In Michigan, for example, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, Republican-controlled legislatures are planning to advance restrictive bills. And new Republican governors would most likely sign them into law if they're elected next year. The 2020 election is behind us, but the war over the future of our democracy is escalating, said Jocelyn Benson, a Democrat who is the Secretary of State in Michigan, where Republicans this week introduced numerous proposed restrictions on voting. For anyone to believe that they can sit down and rest because the 2020 election is behind need look no further than what happened in Georgia as an indication that our work is far from over. Republicans, borrowing language from their previous efforts at curtailing voting access, have described the new bills as a way to make voting easier while limiting fraud. Mr. Kemp, upon signing the bill into law, even said it would make it easier to vote and harder to cheat, even though the state's own Republican election officials found no substantive evidence of fraud in Georgia in November of 2020. Georgia Secretary of State Kemp on Friday, 26th of March, pushed back at President Biden's criticism, saying there is nothing Jim Crow about requiring a photo or state-issued ID to vote by absentee ballot. President Biden, the left, and the national media are determined to destroy the sanctity and security of the ballot box, Kemp said. As Secretary of State in Georgia, I consistently led the fight to protect Georgia elections against power-hungry partisan activists. Jessica Anderson, the executive director of Heritage Action for America, the political arm of the Conservative Heritage Foundation, said Georgia would serve as a model for other Republican-run states. The country was watching closely what Georgia would do, Jessica Anderson said in an interview. The fact that they were able to get these reforms through sets the tone and puts Georgia in a leadership role for other states. The Justice Department was aware of Georgia's voting law, a spokesman said on Friday, but provided no further comment. A White House official said the president, in his comments, was assuming this was an issue the Department of Justice would review. The department's Civil Rights Division would most likely have lawyers investigate whether to file an independent lawsuit, said Tom Perez, the former Labor Secretary who also previously ran the department's Civil Rights Division during the Obama administration. It could also take part in the case that was filed by civil rights groups by filing a so-called statement of interest in moving to intervene as the plaintiff, he said. But this is a precarious time for the federal protections in place. In 2013, the Supreme Court gutted one of the core provisions of the Voting Rights Act, clearing the way for much of the current legislation aimed at restricting voting. The remaining protection in Section 2 of the Act is facing a new challenge before the Supreme Court, with arguments heard last month. The debate is also spilling over into the corporate arena. Activists across the country have been chastising companies they see as silent on the issue of voting rights. In Georgia on Friday, numerous civil rights groups and faith leaders issued a call to boycott some of the standard bearers of the Georgia business community, including Coca-Cola, until they took action against the efforts to restrict voting access in Georgia.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back. I'm Saeed Bourza. Our top story this hour. A grammar school in northern England is the center of media firestorm after suspending a teacher for insulting Islam's prophet Muhammad. The school apologized to parents after a protest movement began outside its gates on Thursday. However, some Brits are unhappy with the school's apology and claim that Muslims are not respecting freedom of speech. Robert Carter was in Batley to find out more.
In the English town of Batley, a local grammar school has caused major controversy after a teacher showed a blasphemous cartoon of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad to students during a religious studies class. Outraged parents of Muslim students began protesting outside the school gates on Thursday, demanding the school take action against Islamophobia.
The incident from Monday, 22nd of March, must also be investigated from a criminal perspective,
yes,
given that it was a clear attempt to stir up religious hatred. We also use this opportunity to call upon the entire British Muslim community to review the materials being taught in their children's schools.
Batley Grammar School reacted quickly, suspending the teacher, launching an investigation, and apologising to parents. However, the British press and politicians have opted to condemn the protesters instead, adding further fuel to the fire.
I was disturbed to see scenes of people protesting outside the school. That is not right. We shouldn't have teachers, members of the staff of schools feeling intimidated.
The creator of the universe, Allah, the most merciful, doesn't need a crowd hanging around outside a school.
Many details about what the protesters have been demanding are not clear. Press TV spoke to locals to find out more.
As far as I know, the parents have been very, very responsible. I mean, many of the protesters are not even parents, and the parents have acted very responsibly, very, very professionally, and they should be commended. You know, they're basically the victims of this situation, but they're also the stars of this situation, that they've basically acted in a calm, collective manner. They've not made any unreasonable demands to the school. They've not asked for anything untoward to happen towards the teacher. They've been very, very responsible, and they should be commended for their stance and for their actions.
The school has acknowledged that the resource used in Monday's lesson was completely inappropriate and had the potential to cause considerable offence within the community. However, many online are now arguing that Muslims need to accept insults on the Holy Prophet as part of freedom of speech, and if they don't like it, they have to essentially lump it. However, with further Muslim action planned elsewhere in the country, and also the media continuing to hype up the story, it's likely that things will continue to escalate going forward. Robert Carter, Batley.
Well, that is a fast-developing story. It's gained a lot of traction. More people are joining in the debate as we speak, and Robert Carter has the latest.
So we've been here for a few hours in Batley. We've been able to speak to some local community members, including people who have attended the protest that took place earlier today. This is at least the second day of protesting that has happened outside the school gates. Now, what the protesters have been saying, and we've been hearing a variety of views expressed, is that they want reassurances from the school that this type of thing won't happen again. It needs to be made clear that the school has acted quickly and quite strongly on this issue, but the investigation is still ongoing, and the teacher remains suspended whilst the investigation continues. So depending on the results of the investigation, the teacher could potentially be brought back to work, or he could potentially be let go. We can only speculate. But many of the protesters have made very, very clear that they want the teacher to be permanently let go, and for this to be essentially to be made an example of. Other protesters have said that they want this debate to be expanded. They want it to go on a national level. They want it to be discussed in Westminster. And I think that there is concern by British Muslims that this type of issue may become mainstream here, that criticism and showing of offensive cartoons of Islam's Holy Prophet will be put into the census, into the curriculum for religious studies here in the UK. That is one of the concerns that's been expressed. Obviously, this debate has gone online now. There are a lot of views being expressed on Twitter. It's also gone into mainstream media circles, and government ministers have actually been commenting on these protests and have actually been condemning the protests, as you saw in the report. Now, what's been happening needs to be made clear is that Islamophobic and right-wing views are being expressed widely. Muslims across the board are being condemned for essentially expressing their views, and the argument of freedom of speech is being put out there against the protesters, saying that, well, you have to put up and shut up. But what many Muslims are saying is that they resent the fact that they're being compared to extremists or terrorists. They also say that their criticism of the school and their wanting to defend Islam's Holy Prophet is a legitimate reason, and ultimately they're saying that this is a freedom of insult situation rather than a freedom of speech debate. So obviously the debate will continue, that's for sure. More protest action is being discussed here, both in Batley and outside of Batley, possibly a protest taking place in Blackburn, a city nearby, tomorrow. So more action is likely to come, and ultimately the media has now turned this into a bit of a circus, and right-wing sentiment is being expressed quite widely in establishment media circles. So this is likely to continue to escalate. We'll have to wait and see how it goes, but ultimately the parents have made clear that they don't support violence or intimidation against the school or any of its staff members, but there are many people here who are not parents that are attending the protests as well.
Robert Carter reporting from Batley for us. To other news, China has announced sanctions on 4 British entities and 9 individuals, among them 5 MPs, for spreading what it called lies and disinformation about the East Asian country. The sanctioned individuals will now be barred from visiting Chinese territory or carrying out financial transactions with Chinese citizens and institutions. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said he stands firmly with MPs and other British citizens, those who have been sanctioned, for speaking out against what he described gross human rights violations. Conservative MP Ian Duncan Smith, a leading China critic, says he'd wear the sanctions as a badge of honor.
It didn't surprise me, to be quite frank with you. The government Magnitsky sanctions on those who they believe have been involved in the terrible abuses in Xinjiang amongst the Uyghur. I mean, we are literally, I believe, seeing genocide take place there in the attempt to sort of exterminate a whole ethnic group. But having done that, the Chinese were bound to retaliate. They've retaliated against European politicians, and we knew that it was going to happen here.
The retaliatory move comes days after the UK government announced its own series of anti-China sanctions. UK and Chinese relations have deteriorated over the last year over London's support for protesters in the former British colony, Hong Kong. Also in this country, MPs have voted to extend the government's emergency coronavirus powers for another 6 months. The bill was passed by 484 votes to 76, despite some rebellion from conservative backbenchers who call the powers draconian and who seek to reopen the country as soon as possible. The Liberal Democrats also opposed the extension, as did the DUP and 21 Labour MPs who defied party instructions to support the measure. The Coronavirus Act was first passed this time last year, but is reviewed and voted on every 6 months. The UK government's proposed policing legislation has met widespread outrage among those who believe it's an authoritarian measure that gives British police too much power. And as Ahmed Caballo reports, Britain's marginalized communities, who are already subject to police harassment, are particularly worried. They feel law enforcement too often abuse the powers they already have.
The conduct of the Metropolitan Police has been in the spotlight recently, following the graphic scenes in Clapham Cop in South London, where uniformed officers were filmed violently confronting women protesters at a vigil for a murder victim, Sarah Everard. Yet for those in the black community, particularly young black men, those scenes would have come as no surprise. In fact, according to British Home Office figures, black people in England and Wales are five times more likely to have force used against them by police than white people. Suleiman Lee has been on the receiving end of this force on more than one occasion, but on the 2nd of September 2016, it happened to be captured on camera as he was distributing books to the community in Brixton, in a clip that went viral.
I saw many officers, and what I noticed is that, you know, as they came up to us and was very, they were very aggressive. So I was just trying to articulate myself, because one thing is the elders that I grew up with, they're not into foolish behavior. They always encourage you to act intelligently. So if I would have acted in a, you know, aggressive manner, or a manner that wasn't, you know, becoming of someone doing the type of work I was doing, I would have been heavily criticized. So I kept it on the law. I kept on trying to articulate my point and keep on that point. And before you knew it, they grabbed me. And when they grabbed me, you know, all I did was, I didn't even fight like that. All I did, they tried to put me on the ground, I just stood up. Because, you know, I said, as Rasta, we're not really bold like that.
However, he does not see himself as a victim. And following the attack by the Metropolitan Police, he was released without charge and returned to the same spot and continued to serve the community.
So when they see some positive brothers, you know, doing something positive for the community, they're not going to like it. But you know what? We don't mind if they don't like it. We just continue what we do. And as I said, the community, because remember, the police, as I said in the last interview, are public servants. Their job is to serve the community. Until the community say to us, we don't want you here no more, or move on, that's our authority, you know. You know, one thing is a term saying the most dangerous black man is an educated black man.
Suleiman is part of a collective called Black Child Promotions, which is a non-profit organisation that distributes empowering media and literature to local communities throughout London since 2003, with a percentage of the donations going to the Mama Arts Centre, a registered charity organisation, and the London branch of the Marcus Garvey Foundation.
It's important for our children because when they go through schools,
And most of the school, and this is the same in the US as it is in England, most of the books do not reflect them. And I'm no psychologist, but I'm saying if you're getting information that's about everybody else and not yourself, you're going to question, where do you fit in this? How come I'm not in the picture?
Suleiman Lee feels he was stereotyped. Instead of seeing a community activist, a family man, and a scholar, the police saw a problem that needed to be dealt with, even though legally speaking, he was doing nothing wrong. Suleiman also went on to complete his master's with distinction from the Anglo Ruskin University in London, and authored a children's book called Great Hope, and developed a board game called Melanopoly. Both projects were in collaboration with Black Love is Black Power and Black Child Promotions.
It's like focusing on what we can do to improve ourselves, because no one's going to help us. We need to help ourselves, and we have to pray to the Most High. What I do anyway, I always say, help me to help myself. I'm not just going to sit back and, you know, because if we leave it up to the police, they're not going to give you any compensation for unlawfully assaulting you. They can just get away with it. They got away with it with Mark Duggan, rest in peace. They got away with it with Smiley Culture, rest in peace. They got away with it with Cynthia Jarrett, rest in peace. And it goes on and it goes on and it goes on. There's no justice, there's no restitution. So again, we must focus on self-development and how we can better ourselves. We live in a lifelong learning economy, yeah, which promotes education, which promotes, you know, mental development. So why would they even come down on somebody that's trying to raise the literacy levels of the community?
At the moment, there's a nationwide discussion in the UK about the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill, which is passed through both legislative houses, will give British police more powers to control protests. Yet a conversation that's been ongoing in the black community is how to stop sections of the British police from abusing the powers they already have, which enable them to stereotype and use force against black men like Suleiman Lee. Ahmed Cabello, London.
The Vice President of the European Commission for Values and Transparency has reiterated the body's condemnation of the brutal assassination of a Maltese investigation journalist in 2017. Daphne Caruana Galizia was murdered after her extensive work on corruption involving Maltese politicians and business figures. Two brothers accused of planning and triggering the car bomb that killed her have asked for a presidential pardon in return for information on a former government minister they claim ordered the killing. Malta's Prime Minister Joseph Muscat resigned last year in the wake of the scandal. An investigation into her murder is ongoing. Moving on to the latest diplomatic spat between Turkey and France. Turkey has condemned the French president's recent warning against Ankara meddling in his country's next presidential election. Foreign Ministry spokesman Hami Aksoy said Macron's unjust and inconsistent statements were unacceptable and contrary to the friendship and alliance between the two countries. France is home to approximately 800,000 Turkish expats. Ankara has warned against alienating them for political expediency. All the way to South America, the Venezuelan government has ordered a formal investigation into the country's U.S.-backed opposition figure, Juan Guaido, accusing him of seizing $7 billion from the country. Attorney General Tarek William Saab called Guaido and his allies a criminal gang of a transnational character. The Venezuelan government says the money is vital for the purchase of COVID-19 vaccines and food. In January 2019, Juan Guaido proclaimed himself the interim president of Venezuela after rejecting the landslide victory of incumbent Nicolas Maduro in the May 2018 presidential elections.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
In in this segment four resolutions against Israel adopted by the UN Human Rights Council on the human rights situation in Palestine and other occupied Arab territories. Joining me to fill us in on the details, Robert in location. Robert, a lot of disappointment in Tel Aviv.
Absolutely. They've lashed out and called the United Nations yet again, as they do with anyone who criticizes them ever, it seems, anti-Semitic. Now, this story has gone pretty much unreported by the mainstream press we've seen, despite the fact that the United Nations Human Rights Council has voted on four different resolutions, one of which was adopted on the 23rd of this month, calling for an arms embargo on Israel due to its crimes committed against the Palestinian people in the occupied territories. And we know this comes just in the wake of the ICC, that's International Criminal Court, announcement that it will open an investigation into war crimes committed in the occupied territories. And so Israel is not happy, and many of its traditional allies voted for the bills being pushed through, specifically the three latter bills, which were passed on the 24th. Germany voted for them. They condemned Israel's settlement expansion and condemned it as an occupier, an illegal occupier. But what we aren't seeing is any really UN focus, unfortunately, on the ongoing ethnic cleansing of East Jerusalem al-Quds. 2,100 Palestinians are under immediate threat of expulsion by Israeli settler groups who are going to the Israeli courts in order to try and have them expelled. In some cases, in the case of Sheikh Jarrah, for instance, we've seen that the Israeli settlers will go in and attempt to take those homes for themselves.
My question to you, Robert, briefly, is will these resolutions bring about any tangible change in Israel's behavior on the ground?
Well, we haven't seen this in the past. These are four more resolutions to add to over 100 resolutions which have been adopted in the past by the Human Rights Council. We see this nearly on a yearly basis, that there are new resolutions passed against Israel by the Human Rights Council. It's the resolutions which are adopted by the Security Council, which are the ones which are more meaningful, which are supposed to be all binding. However, even those are often ignored by the international community. We've seen time and time again that Israel has been called upon to stop its settlement expansion and that countries should punish it for it, but we're seeing no sanctions, no arms embargoes. So unfortunately, a lot of criticism online of this, actually, that no countries act.
Okay, let's allow Twitter users to weigh in on this, Robert.
Well, echoing what I just said there, we've got many people saying very similar things online. In fact, the first we've got is from a Twitter user called Bob Hilger, who says, "These resolutions happen so often, but what is the point if Israel is never punished? The UN is completely useless because nobody ever listens to it." And we've got another one here from a user called Ahmed, who says, "Israel is a terrorist regime, and still we see that nothing is done to stop them. Great to hear that the UN has tried to get an arms embargo, but the US will never listen."
All right, let's move on to your second story. When the protest happened in Brussels last week over the new UK government policing bill, when it turned ugly, there were reports of police having been injured, broken bones, and punctured lungs, but now the police have retracted those statements.
Absolutely, and many people are pointing out that the opposition to this police crime and sentencing bill, which we saw result in these protests, is being very much proven correct, that if the police are able to lie like this with impunity, I assume that there is no punishment for them lying to the media in order to garner public support or sympathy. That's what we would assume in this case, is why they would lie about something like this, or attempt to mislead on an issue like this, like bones being broken of officers, punctured lungs, etc., and then rolling back on it. Because in this new police crime and sentencing bill, the police would have the power to essentially end protests, fine people over £2,500 potentially for speaking too loud on a loudspeaker if they decided that that was incorrect or if it threatened the community in a certain circumstance. We've seen that for pulling down statues now, you will get potentially 10 years in prison. And so the police could easily lie in order to justify utilizing aspects of this bill which aren't actually valid and applicable to the circumstance which they are in. And on top of that as well, we know that police officers often escalate situations which prior to them, of course, escalating into a lot of violence with the police did not exist there. So they manufacture these situations to put them down and suppress free speech.
Right. Let's see what people have had to say about this.
The first we have here is by a Twitter user called Richard Murphy, who says, "We really should expect the police to tell the truth. After all, that's their demand of us, and the respect has to be reciprocal if there is to be trust. This was not good enough." We've got another one here as well by Richard Seymour, who says, "The lie did its job, ensuring the story wouldn't be about police tactics. Now it can be quietly walked back."
And Robert, this whole thing, the protests came in the wake of the thing that went wrong during the Sarah Everard vigil, the call for the police commissioner to resign. So they were really not in a very strong position. And by allegedly lying about the events that went down in Bristol, probably aimed at winning public sympathies for, you know, the good job that the police is doing in protecting people.
Absolutely, but of course trust is declining when they commit acts like this. And on top of that as well, what we've seen that you know, this bill that is being pushed, within it what we're seeing is that specifically